Scene 46 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming award-winning author Peter Annan Wednesday evening, April 24th. He will present the inaugural lecture in the Gunderson Lecture Series titled Great Lakes Water Tension in the 21st Century. Annan will discuss the challenges we face regarding sustainable water practices. A reception and book signing to follow. This event is free and open to the public. Details at carthage.edu/Gunderson. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea. A Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again. And that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Anybody who lives in Milwaukee or even visits Milwaukee and goes down to the lakefront and sees that beautiful park area has enjoyed, probably without even realizing it, the legacy of a great genius by the name of Frederick Law Olmsted. Early in the book, author Justin Martin says that this is maybe the most important American historical figure that the average person knows the least about. In fact, it's fair to say that a fair number of intelligent Americans know absolutely nothing about Frederick Law Olmsted, at least not specifically. But when you begin to realize all that he is responsible for, it becomes very clear that this is an important American who not only influenced our country, but also is very much a reflection of who we are and have been. Frederick Law Olmsted is responsible for designing some of the most important park areas in the country, probably most famously Central Park in New York City, but also the beautiful parkland on along the lakefront of Milwaukee, the grounds of what was known as the Columbian Exposition in Chicago, some remnants of which certainly survive to today, and parks across the country, college campuses as well. But on top of that, Olmsted was also important as a journalist and abolitionist, and also as an environmentalist, helping shape a new consciousness about preserving wild places. And all of this amazing legacy is described and celebrated in this new book called Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted, published by Da Capo Press. The author, Justin Martin, is responsible for two previous books, Greenspan, The Man Behind Money, and Nader, Crusader Spoiler Icon. Again, this new book about Frederick Law Olmsted is called Genius of Place. Justin Martin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
I'm really looking forward to this.
Myself as well.
I am a little struck by the progression from Alan Greenspan to Ralph Nader to Frederick Law Olmsted. Is there some sort of connective sweep there that I am missing?
There is, at least for me personally, and the connective sweep is I really love reading and also writing biographies about people who've had varied lives. I remember years ago I read a biography of a musician in which the musician's life story was basically he showed an early prodigious talent for music. He continued along the vein of music. He then wrote his first hit song, followed by his second hit song, followed by many other hit songs, some battles with his record company and drug addiction along the way, but otherwise it was just music, music, music. And I found that I actually like to do biographies of figures such as Olmsted or Ralph Nader or Greenspan, all of whom were late bloomers and all of whom had many diverse sort of eddies that they traveled down before they found their way into their life's work. So I just for personal, for reading and writing pleasure, I like that kind of figure.
And that, of course, gives you all the more to write about, especially in the case of Olmsted. What a fascinating checkered life he had in the early going. And actually, even once he began achieving great success, it was still a life that was sort of pockmarked by difficulty of one kind or another.
So very true. Now, he was somebody who very much learned kind of in the school of life. He had many, many different endeavors. And even once he did his first masterpiece, Central Park, even having done that, he wasn't so certain. It was a different era. He wasn't certain that there was going to be any demand for landscape architecture. So even after having this monumental achievement to his credit, he went on and did several other things before he finally was almost forced into service designing landscapes around the country. And he's also, as you described, somebody who these landscapes aren't just they're certainly beautiful places, but the beauty, as it is the case for so many artists, grows out of the tumult of his personal life. His personal life was full of tragedy, and he took that tragedy, as so many great artists do, and he turned it into beauty with the parks.
Very early in the book, you talk about your own personal connection to Central Park. This is a great little story. Tell us about the first day that you enjoyed some pleasure and respite on the beautiful grounds of Central Park.
Sure. I arrived in New York City fresh from college. I went to college in Houston. And when I arrived in New York City and had a round of interviews my first day, I found it. I mean, I found the city, as many visitors or people who arrived for the first time, I just found the city overwhelming. I could not believe how hectic it was. Nothing had prepared me for it. And, you know, of course, it was compounded by the fact that I was doing a series of job interviews throughout the day. So it was very, very stressful day. At the end of the day, it was almost an instinct. I'd heard about this place, Central Park. I'd heard it was a place of you know, respite. So I thought I'm probably the right place for me to go at the tail end of this day of hectic interviews. So I walked into the park and just found the stresses of the day just melted away. At the time, of course, I was 22 years old, fresh from college. I had no idea who Frederick Olmsted was. Wouldn't really learn that for several years of park use before I became curious about that. But I realized in retrospect, in that very day, I was using the park as it was meant to be used, and I was Olmsted's vision was having a calming effect on me.
You write that you were later married in Central Park, and then ultimately came to live in a special planned community, Forest Hills, that Olmsted had designed and which some regarded as his masterpiece.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I was married in Central Park in a building called The Dairy, and The Dairy at the time was an event space. It was designed by Calvert Vaux, Olmsted's partner, and it's really the most beautiful building ever designed, I would say, for the benefit of cattle. That was what it was originally for, a working dairy in the park. Now it's a visitor center, and it was an event space when I was married there. Great place to be married. And then ultimately I moved out to Forest Hills Gardens, which was a neighborhood designed by Frederick Law Olmsted Jr., who is Olmsted's son, of course. And he was a little bit more of an urban planner than Olmsted, a little bit less of a park maker, although he certainly did many notable parks around the country, more of an urban planner designing communities and neighborhoods and so forth. And Forest Hills Gardens, beautiful community that's literally a quick subway ride from New York, from Manhattan, is often considered his masterpiece as an urban planner. And at about that point, the point I moved out here, I started to think as a biographer, I think my next subject is kind of staring me in the face.
I also want you to make mention of the remarkable way in which your book actually begins, with a dramatic moment in March of 1893. It is on the eve of the opening of the famous Columbian Exposition, right down the road from us, in the heart of downtown Chicago. And a speech is being given by Daniel Burnham, who is being honored at this gala event. But he takes this moment in the spotlight to actually divert the attention and praise away from himself to Frederick Law Olmsted. Tell us about this dramatic moment.
It was certainly a dramatic moment. You had gathered at the old Madison Square Garden in New York City a collection of really notable landscape architects, people like Richard Morris Hunt, who had worked on the Columbian Exposition. The person chosen to be feted that night was Daniel Burnham, the just absolutely brilliant architect, and also just the dynamo force behind the 1893 World Exposition in Chicago. And there was a series of stereoscopic images. This was at a point at which the fair, which has just been a breakneck exercise. I mean, all these notable architects and other artists and so forth had to rush at tremendous speed to have this really important patriotic event that was going to place America on the world stage to get it done in time. And in March, before the fair was actually to open on May 1st, when it was clear that the fair was really going to open on time and on schedule and be a striking event as was planned, they had this event, and there was a series of stereoscopic images projected onto the wall that included some of the really striking things like the famous Statue of the Republic, the big gold sort of Statue of Liberty-like statue. And it culminated with an image of Daniel Burnham, the power behind the fair. And when he took the stage, he chose to sort of divert attention away from himself, and he made a wonderful, flowery 19th century series of comments that I can't possibly reproduce, but where he basically said, you know, the real, you know, all the thank you for, you know, for feting me so kindly, but the person who really deserves the credit here is Frederick Law Olmsted, who's been, you know, who's painted with his, you know, with his landscapes for all these many years. It was a very powerful tribute, and it was really kind of an acknowledgement that Olmsted, who is by this time in his late 60s, it was kind of an acknowledgement of his accomplishments and achievements.
Hmm. Burnham said this about Mr. Olmsted: an artist, he paints with lakes and wooden slopes, with lawns and banks and forest-covered hills, with mountainsides and ocean views. He should stand where I do tonight, not for the deeds of later years alone, but for what his brain has wrought and his pen has taught for half a century.
That's wonderful. Yeah. People knew how to speak in the 19th century.
Absolutely. And of course, he was fully deserving of those words of praise. We're speaking with Justin Martin, and we're talking about his new book, Genius of Place, which examines the remarkable life and legacy of Frederick Law Olmsted, and a tremendously important and influential American who many of us know very, very little about. We've already touched on the fact that he was something of a late bloomer. And something else I want to have you remark on is something you say in the first chapter of the book, I believe, when you say that it is so fortunate that Olmsted emerged in America in the 19th century, because it was an ideal time for someone with such a wide array of gifts. You go on to say it was a time when it didn't make sense to be a specialist, mm-hmm. but someone a little more like, I suppose, a Renaissance man like Olmsted had the potential to be spectacularly successful. Tell us more about why this was such a great time for someone like Olmsted to emerge.
I came to the conclusion while researching the book that America in that era was a frontier society, both physically, I mean, vast, open, undiscovered spaces in some cases, and also psychologically. It was a new country. There were many fewer people. There were great works to be done, and there was a kind of all hands on deck mentality that Olmsted and many other figures from that era were very much the beneficiaries of. Basically, if you expressed a desire to do some particular endeavor, it was not like today where people would say if you're trying to make the transition, say, from one type of doctor specializing in one area to another type of doctor, people might throw up their arms and say, oh, you're going to need to go back to school for that. In that era, if you said, I'd like to make this radical transition from this to that, it was basically welcome. You know, we need workers, we need people who are energetic, all hands on deck. And Olmsted really, really benefited from that sort of ethos of that era.
Hmm. When you describe his childhood to us, one event which looms quite significantly is his mother's very sudden death. And this seems to have been a source of sadness for him, as of course we well understand. In the wake of that, it seems that one of the most powerful memories Olmsted had from his childhood was a walk through a meadow with his father, which, of course, would seem to be maybe an interesting precursor for what might be ahead for him.
Very true. No, he enjoyed a lot of what his father described as loitering journeys as a boy through the Connecticut countryside. And these loitering journeys, actually his father would put little Olmsted on a pillow on right in front of the horse's saddle, and they'd ride through the Connecticut countryside. And they'd often ride through in just hushed silence. and it was a kind of a reverent silence. And Olmsted, and his father was a gentleman and a man of few words. And so Olmsted, these loitering journeys that Olmsted would take, they really had a deep effect on him and a deep effect on his appreciation of the landscape. And there was one in particular that you described where they'd actually gotten down off the horse, and it was late in the day, early evening, and his father was carrying him across a meadow. And Olmsted made some kind of comment about the stars that were coming out that night, and his father made some kind of comment about the infinite of his love for Olmsted. And as I said, he was a man of few words, so in this kind of atmosphere of hushed reverence for his father to respond to chatty little five-year-old Olmsted by saying something about feeling infinite love for him, and particularly in the wake of him having lost his mother at an early age, it was really something that he literally almost clung to that memory for the rest of his life.
Right. And one senses that perhaps there was a real connection between moments like that and his deep appreciation for a human being's need to have beautiful places to which to retreat.
I think that's very apt. He had so much loss in his life, and I guess one way of looking at it is I guess any art is an attempt to create something beautiful, and hopefully it'll have some permanence. The landscapes, the particular artistic medium that he worked in, I mean, not only do they hopefully have some permanence, but beyond that, they affect people in a very sort of a full immersion experience. It's not just looking at a painting or looking at or listening to a piece of music. In the case of the artworks he created, which are designed to edify people and give them peace in certain ways, they're fully immersive experiences. People walk through them and experience them calm or appreciation of nature or what have you.
You tell us that as Olmsted grew, he developed a restless intelligence. I really love that turn of phrase, and I wonder if you could just talk a bit more about this restless intelligence and what it said about where he went from there.
Sure. He was somebody who really absorbed a lot. He absorbed a lot of the landscapes that he visited as a child with his father. As he grew older, he began to just became a voracious reader. His schooling was very sort of slipshod, and yet he was immensely well read, and he found his way to various books just out of passion. And often these books were of immense personal meaning to him. There's a book called Solitude that was about the need the thesis of solitude was that nature is a place where a person can go for comfort, and they need to retreat from mankind periodically. And that book really stuck with him. So he was a very avid reader, and then he began to try a whole series of different endeavors where he took this, what was obviously, I think of it almost like a search lamp, that he was just shining on different things, and he had this intensity. And some of these things didn't bear up to the search lamp, is the best way to put it. I mean, they weren't, for him personally, they didn't provide enough stimulation or interest or what have you. He tried being a clerk, and he very quickly grew tired of that. He tried being a surveyor, and that didn't take. He was a sailor, certainly a job that's full of adventure and so forth, and he had a long line of seafaring Olmsteds of Connecticut that preceded him, but that didn't take. He tried being a scientific farmer, something that he thought would really, in that era when America was mostly an agrarian society, he thought, particularly as a literate farmer, someone who could read and could read journals about the latest techniques and so forth, he thought he could learn about farming, that he could then turn to his fellow farmers, many of whom were not literate in that era, and he could help them by teaching them the latest techniques. And that really seemed to him at the time. He threw himself, as he did so many things, sailing or what have you, with intense passion into this exercise of being a scientific farmer. And for a while, he was really, sort of passionately caught up in being a farmer, and then that also started to dissipate, I feel like, in part because he just, in some way, he was searching, casting about with that restless intelligence for something that would really be a fitting career for him to pursue.
I thought it was interesting that you also characterized this long phase of his life, this sort of early adulthood, as a point when he appeared to be, more than anything, rather adrift, maybe lacking any sense of real urgency in terms of finding his calling. You write, as though following his own private calendar. In other words, sometimes people are adrift or restless, and there is this anxiousness about that. I mean, as though they are feeling kind of increasingly desperate about trying to find their place in the world. But at least at certain points in Olmsted's life, it seems that his restlessness was not exactly that.
Yes, it's really interesting. One thing I'd say about Olmsted is I read probably thousands of letters by him. He was too modest of a man to ever say about himself that he was marked for greatness. Other people who were his friends, his father, certainly felt that way. And like other people who have that quality about them, there was something about him. He was very restless, but there was also, it was almost contradictory. He was very restless, but there was also sort of a calm sense that something great lay out there. And so he would try. I mean, he would try many more things than the average person would try, many more endeavors. He failed at many things, and he had some kind of sense. It seemed like almost a manifest destiny that something, you know, that something grand lay out there for him. And so it accounted for his restlessness. It made him, you know, if something wasn't taking, if something wasn't giving him the satisfaction he sought or the glory that he sought, he'd move on to the next, and it might be a spectacular failure, and he'd pick himself up and dust himself from that and move on to the next. And so there was a kind of a curious, you could say there was a restlessness, but also maybe at the core of it, a kind of calm sense or a certainty that something out there was awaiting him where he could really make his mark and achieve something grand.
We're speaking with Justin Martin about his fascinating book, Genius of Place, which examines the life and legacy of Frederick Law Olmsted. You tell us in a interesting little sneak preview of what was to come that during this period when he was a so-called scientific farmer, the second farm maybe that he had, he set about trying to really improve it in a way which we might view as his first attempt at landscape architecture.
It very much was, and it kind of came naturally to him. He didn't have any great ambition with this. At this point, his ambition was to be a talented and celebrated scientific farmer. Something was possible to do in that era. And he set about making various improvements to land. They really came almost intuitively to him. He wanted, he was close to a harbor, and so he moved a barn so he had a better view of the harbor. He created a curving path up to his farmhouse. He just thought that was a more attractive approach to the farmhouse. He planted some trees in certain places. He created an ornamental pond. And the interesting thing was Staten Island, where he was farming at that time, was a place where he was a farmer by profession, but there were many kind of gentleman farmers who from nearby New York City who might have a weekend hobby farm of some sort. And those included William Vanderbilt, who then was probably the richest man in the world, had a farm on Staten Island. So some of those neighbors, including William Vanderbilt, saw the improvements that Olmsted had made to his farm, and they actually asked Olmsted to make improvements to their farms. And so he did those, and in the era, it was before he even had an inkling that he would become a landscape architect. He sort of helped out some of his fellow gentleman farmers by designing their grounds.
At some point, Olmsted ended up exploring journalism. And one of the most important moments in that venture was meeting someone named Andrew Jackson Downing, who proved to be an important influence on him.
That's very true. No, Olmsted, the fact that he was a farmer got him the kind of gig you could never get today from simply by being a farmer. He was conscripted by the brand new New York Times, a startup publication, to go around the American South and do dispatches on slavery and plantation life. And the reason he was given that just incredible assignment was in part because he was a farmer, and he'd be traveling to the South and meeting with other farmers and interviewing him, so he was very well qualified for this job. Upon getting this particular job, Olmsted made a kind of pilgrimage to see a man named Andrew Jackson Downing, who in this era, you might describe him as almost like a Martha Stewart. He was an incredibly important tastemaker in 19th century life. He was somebody, he was the editor of a magazine called The Horticulturist, and The Horticulturist was full of pronouncements on how people should live in a rural setting. It was read by the very gentleman farmers, hobby farmers, and so forth, who Olmsted met on Staten Island and people elsewhere around the country who had weekend homes or farms, or also it was read by gentlemen farmers of means who wanted to make sure that they were sort of aesthetically correct. And so the Horticulturist that Andrew Jackson Downing edited was full of dictates like if you have a home in nature, don't have symmetrical touches. That's Those are human touches. You know, allow asymmetry, allow nature to rule, or don't clear cut the nice trees around your farmhouse. That's the way that subsistence grubbing pioneers behave themselves. If you're a true appreciator of nature, let trees grow profusely around your land. So those were So Olmsted made a pilgrimage up to Newburgh, New York, where Andrew Jackson Downing lived and met with the great man. And out of that meeting, he got a few assignments to write. I think he wrote a piece for the Horticulturalist on the cultivation of pears and a few other items, which represent some of Olmsted's early journalistic work.
What, of course, becomes more important to him is in traveling the South, when Olmsted begins to see firsthand the consequences of slavery. And he writes extensively about slavery. You tell us something so interesting about Olmsted that in at least early on, as he first became concerned with the plight of slaves, Olmsted was what we call a gradualist. And then eventually discarded this view of what needed to be done in response to slavery. Can you say a quick word about that?
Certainly, yeah. When he got started, he got the assignment, as I mentioned, because he was a farmer. He also got the assignment in part because the New York Times, even as a startup, it had a vision. It wanted to be a kind of objective voice. And this was a time of yellow journalism. This was also a time when most metropolitan areas, big metropolitan areas like New York, had a number of competing dailies. There are about 12 daily papers in New York. 11 of them in this era were full of yellow journalism. So the Times decided to distinguish itself by being a more objective paper. And so Olmsted was instructed, and he certainly fit the bill, that when he went down and did these dispatches from the South, that he needed to really be impartial. They didn't want to send a fervent abolitionist down there to meet with plantation owners and talk to slaves and so forth. Olmsted fit the bill because he had a stance shared by so many Northerners, which you described as gradualism. I mean, he believed that slavery was wrong, but he thought for a state's right issue, he didn't think that one state had any right or one region of the country had any right to impose its views on another region. He also, as a farmer, he had a concern shared by many Northerners that if there was immediate emancipation, that the North might be flooded with black people, some of whom would be underqualified, and they'd wind up on the public rolls. So he had this view, and then when he went down, he couldn't have picked a better person to go down for the New York Times and cover the South, because Olmsted approached the South with an open mind, and what he ultimately concluded, it made it very powerful. He went through a transition, ultimately concluded that slavery was wrong as an economic system, that slavery was morally wrong. To have somebody approach it with an open mind and come to those conclusions was much more powerful for the Times dispatches than had they simply sent an existing abolitionist down to do the job. Hmm.
Do I remember that, at least in part, it was Olmsted seeing the sight of a female slave being brutally whipped that was at least in part a force in
it sure was. It was a really decisive event for him. He had come to the conclusion already that slavery was an economically inefficient system, and he'd written very persuasively on that topic. But one thing that happened throughout his Southern travels is the various plantation owners he met with jealously guarded an ugly aspect of their treatment of slaves from Olmsted. I mean, Olmsted was clearly a Northerner who was down there writing about plantation life, and so they certainly weren't going to get comfortable and whip a slave in front of him. But along the way, he happened to talk to a foreman who, I guess, became comfortable with Olmsted in his presence, and right in front of him, the foreman did something Olmsted had not witnessed. He'd certainly heard tell of it while he'd been traveling to the South, and he'd certainly heard tell of it when he talked to slaves directly, but he actually witnessed this foreman spotted a slave who was sort of hiding in the bushes and shirking her duties in the foreman's estimation. So the foreman whipped the slave brutally. And Olmsted, it was a very powerful and painful experience for Olmsted in many ways. First of all, Olmsted felt complicit as a white person sitting there and watching this event. And as you might imagine, he didn't stop the event. He simply witnessed it. That made Olmsted feel very guilty because he felt what he witnessed was very morally wrong. Another thing that really struck Olmsted, someone who's passionate about nature, was his own horse during the slave incident suddenly let out a whinny and ran up out of the gully they were in. And Olmsted interpreted that as that the horse, a natural creature, had sensed something was very, very amiss here. And it really shaped Olmsted's views about slavery and really pushed him towards being what he ultimately became, a very fervent abolitionist.
I wonder if, as we are about to turn to this grand phase of Olmsted's life in which he becomes this famous landscape architect with Central Park, among others, as his proud honor roll of achievements. If we could make a connection between his social concerns as an abolitionist, for one, but also as just in general kind of a reformer and someone who thought deeply about issues in terms of various classes of people and the rights of every human being, and how this figured in his thinking when it came to, for instance, designing a place like Central Park.
Absolutely. It's very clear that when, as I described earlier with Olmsted's, his restless intelligence, he wanted very much to be part of his times. And people who came of age in the 1840s, as he did, it was a very socially conscious, social reform-oriented age. And he tried a variety of things, such as scientific farming, that he thought maybe would be good outlets for this desire to for social reform. Ultimately, park making just really fit the bill. He was such a natural at it. He'd had the experiences as a young boy traveling around the Connecticut countryside, which had given him a passion for landscape. But he also really perceived, in an era in which cities were starting, and New York City, of course, was a particular culprit in this area, cities were becoming teeming and dense. And so he saw that a park, such as Central Park or any of the other parks he designed, was a place, a democratic place, a place for everyone. And one of the most interesting things with Olmsted was he had a naturalistic aesthetic. He did not want to design. In fact, he balked at any efforts or a request to design sort of what you might describe as imperial parks, parks that had grand archways and huge fountainry that were celebrating powerful politicians or business figures. He felt that if you're in one of those parks, it might serve as a constant reminder for most people, of their lowly station in life, that there were more powerful forces that were dictating their lives. If you create a naturalistic park, such as Central Park or Lake Park in Milwaukee or any of his other many, many parks, it would belong to everyone. Nature belongs to everyone. And so that was one aesthetic. And then per what you asked about specifically, too, about how his Southern experience affected him, Olmsted, the whole time he was in the South, one thing he was struck by was what he would have termed cultural poverty. He was struck by the fact that these plantations were at such great remove, one from another, that there was no real cultural commerce between the plantation owners. And he once said that as he traveled to the South, he didn't see a single piano fort. He saw rarely a work of Shakespeare. And so it's very much the case that Central Park, which the design of it began in 1858 on the eve of the Civil War, it was also kind of an assertion of Northern cultural supremacy, an effort to bring people of all kinds together in a space, versus what he'd seen in the South, where people lived at great remove, didn't have much cultural commerce between them, and were also able to maintain a very ugly institution, slavery.
Hmm. Tell us sort of the chance meeting, which is part of how Olmsted became involved in this project of Central Park. This is probably as good a time as any to say that plans were already underway. It's not that Olmsted came up with the idea that in the middle of Manhattan there should be this sizable park. I mean, that idea was already in the air. Tell us how Olmsted became involved in it.
That's right. The idea was already in the air. There was already a plan afoot to create a new park. It was going to be designed by someone else. And what happened was that the design that was to be done by somebody else, a man named Calvert Vaux, was aware of this design. He thought it was a very amateurish design. And Calvert Vaux, as it happens, was the one-time assistant and architectural partner of Andrew Jackson Downing, the man we described earlier who was the rural tastemaker of the 19th century. Andrew Jackson Downing had died, and so Calvert Vaux, when he stepped forward and said, hey, the existing plan for Central Park is really very amateurish, they listened to him. He had the imprimatur of Andrew Jackson Downing behind him. And Calvert Vaux further said, hey, listen, I was born in England. And in England, when we want to make sure that the best design for, say, a building is put into place, we have a public competition. He recommended a public competition. And the commissioners who were planning to have this new park built very soon agreed to hold a public competition to see what was the best design that emerged. Vaux then went and selected as a partner Frederick Law Olmsted. Olmsted at this time, this was right after a terrible economic event in American history, the panic of 1857. Olmsted, who'd been working as a journalist, had lost his job as a journalist, He was in bad shape. He was in debt to a lot of people. He was low on coal. He had a big hole in his hat. And so he had taken a really kind of unattractive job. He was clearing the piece of land that was to be Central Park, you know, just knocking down shanties and draining miry swamps to prepare it for another design. Vox noted that Olmsted was out on the grounds, you know, knocking down shanties and so forth. So, hey, if I team up with this guy, maybe I'll have a leg up in this public competition because this guy, Olmsted, has been out on the grounds. He must be familiar with the terrain.
So the fact that Olmsted would really know the terrain and could work with true accuracy, not just guesswork, that was what was seen as what he would bring to this project, not so much any brilliance or talent.
That's exactly right. Vox had no. Vox was underwhelmed or uninterested in the fact that Olmsted was a pretty notable journalist who'd gone on hard times. And as to whether Olmsted had any ability any kind of incredible native ability when it came to landscape, that would have been something completely unknown to Vox and probably unknown to Olmsted as well.
So interesting. This competition was laid out in which there were certain things that were required to be part of each entry. I mean, if you were going to submit a design for Central Park, your entry had to have certain elements in it. Although I think you tell us also that ultimately Olmsted and Vox played a little bit loose with some of those requirements and won the competition anyway.
That's right. They turned in. There were 33 entries came in. 32 of them you could kind of shift into one, you know, put them on one side of the ledger. Olmsted and Vox's plan was was instantly recognized as just brilliant. It was such a departure from the other plans. It was a departure, first of all, because it was a ruralistic plan, where the other plans were often imperial parks. They were full of, you know, foundry. One of them was a celebration of the founding fathers with crazy archways and lakes named Washington Lake and so forth. So that was the first thing that separated Olmsted and Vox's plan, was it was a rural treatment of a park versus a sort of one that was full of statues and fountainry and archways. Another huge difference was there was a mandatory requirement that roads cross the new Central Park, the Central Park, to be in four different spots. All the other 32 plans just complied, and so they carved up their park plan. I mean, Central Park's pretty small when you really get down to it. And now you've got it carved up by four roads crossing at four points. It means you can't have a big meadow, you can't have a very nice vista. Olmsted and Vox came up with this brilliant idea, which was that these subterranean channels, what they called sunken transverses, that traveled across those four, that created those four mandatory crossings. And the effect of that, as Olmsted described, and Olmsted said that as you're walking across the park, you wouldn't have your view interrupted, as he said, by a clattering dung cart. Instead, the dung cart would travel through the subterranean channel, and Olmsted and Vox designed land bridges to cross the channels at certain points. And so that allowed you to have a sort of a longer vista or even an open meadow. Those subterranean channels, those transverses, exist to this day. And when you walk through Central Park, part of the reason that when you're in the middle of New York City, you can really sort of lose yourself in thought is because taxis and buses and other traffic travels in the subterranean channels, and often the sound is muffled and your view isn't broken by those items. So Olmsted and Vox were just brilliant in how different their plan was the other plans, and the sunken transverses were a particular touch of brilliance that had helped clinch it for them that they would win the competition.
They won the competition, but one of the things you also outline in your book is how there was struggle involved in maintaining what they had envisioned for Central Park, and that there were other perspectives that continued to intrude. Go ahead. And I'm especially wondering, what was there a concerted effort to turn Central Park into another kind of space, or was it just kind of the meddling of various people just chiming in with their own contributions? I mean, what are we talking about here in terms of the struggle to guide Central Park towards completion?
In its earliest days, as you might imagine, New York City, like so many big cities, was just a babble of different contradictory voices. And so even though the park plan had won with the park commissioners, as you might imagine, people started to weigh in various ways, suggesting other ideas. And people thought, that maybe Olmsted and Vox's plan should be tweaked or altered or changed in various ways, and some of these suggested changes were very radical, and sometimes they came from very powerful parties. For instance, August Belmont, a man who people might recognize, he's a 19th century financier who's still remembered today for the Belmont Stakes horse race. He was a horse racing aficionado. He felt, this is his word here, he was a powerful man, and he ran a series of advertorials in the New York newspapers in which he said that Olmsted and Vaux's design was grotesque. That was his word. And the reason he felt it was grotesque was because he thought that the transition from New York City, a very man-made entity, into a rural park would be very jarring. He thought it would be a very strange thing. He felt that a proper park should really celebrate the wonders of human engineering. And so he had all kinds of recommendations for giant suspension bridges and all kinds of other things, the kind of engineering marvels that people would be wowed by in this park. Now, the interesting thing was, as I mentioned earlier, Olmsted was a very accomplished journalist. So Olmsted, you couldn't have picked a better person to be a park maker than someone who also wore a second hat as a journalist in that era. Olmsted was able to go to various people such as Henry Raymond, the powerful editor of the New York Times, who had assigned Olmsted the cover of the South, and say, hey, August Belmont just ran an advertorial in your paper. Let me give you my side of the story. And dutifully, Henry Raymond and Horace Greeley, a name people might recognize, who was then editor of a New York paper, and many other people dutifully wrote articles countervailing Belmont's perspective and presenting Olmsted's side of the story. And so Olmsted kind of, it was a kind of a 19th century public relations battle, and Olmsted trounced his rival Belmont, even though Belmont was obviously a powerful and wealthy man.
I'm just realizing now, in a new way, even beyond reading your book, how radical some of Olmsted's ideas were, that for the wealthy, they lived in mansions which had beautiful sculptured yards and gardens to which they could retreat. And so they probably did not begin to fully appreciate what a place like Central Park would mean to somebody who lived in crowded tenement buildings, or who were caught up in the poorer neighborhoods of New York City, where the last thing anybody had was space for their own.
And you're so right. One of the things that Olmsted was really important to him was in that era. It's hard to even imagine, because in today's era, if a person of not much means can leave a city pretty easily, if nothing else, they can, you know, if need be, perhaps they can get a bus or what have you. It's possible to get out of a city and get into the countryside if one so desires. In that era, you had people who were living in teeming Manhattan who literally, they could not even get across the river to Brooklyn, which was less developed, and maybe amble in a, you know, in an open space there. So you had really people who were living in incredibly dense environments. And Olmsted's favorite part of Central Park, the thing that he was most proud of, was an area called the Ramble. And the Ramble is just the Ramble is kind of a simple idea in 21st century terms. So in the 19th century, it was kind of radical. Right in the middle of New York City, in the Ramble in Central Park, it was to be a place where plants could just grow in profusion without anything barring or anything acting as a barrier. So they could big wild beds of plants growing and intermingling and so forth. It was one of the biggest hits in Central Park when the park first opened. People loved to walk through the Ramble. The reason why is you had a lot of people who lived in tenements who their closest association for nature, sadly, might be a flower box where they had a few flowers that were planted and, you know, caught a little bit of sunlight. To be able to go to Central Park and to walk through this Ramble and see flowers just growing in profusion was wondrous, and it made that particular feature of the park, which is now, you know, an attractive feature of the park, but it's been forgotten how revolutionary and also what a big hit that was when it was first unveiled. Hmm.
In the wake, of course, of Central Park, Olmsted goes on to an extraordinary career designing parks and college campuses all across the country. I think I'd certainly be remiss if I didn't give you an opportunity to maybe say a word about, for instance, the great work he did in the city of Milwaukee with what's come to be known as the Grand Necklace of Parks, which are such an inviting feature of the city. His work in Milwaukee comes actually towards the very, very end of his career, not long before senility actually forces his retirement.
Yeah, no, the work he did in Milwaukee, and I was actually in Milwaukee a few weeks ago and really enjoyed visiting those parks. it was a park system. He came in 1893, late in his career, but the benefit to Milwaukee of it being late in Olmsted's career was he had fully formed some of his great ideas. One of his greatest innovations was what's called the park system. And the idea of the park system is that you, rather than having a single piece of land that's set aside for a park, in the way of a central park, you have several pieces of land that might have different attributes. They might one of them might be good for active recreation, like sports. Another might be good for sort of contemplation of nature and so forth. What's interesting is the Milwaukee Park Commission, they actually asked Olmsted to come and do a park system. So they'd already selected the parcels of land. But the reason they asked Olmsted to do a park system is because Olmsted was the one who invented the idea of the park system. He invoked the very first one in the world in Buffalo back in 1868. By the time he got to Milwaukee, Olmsted had perfected this idea. And as I said, it was late in his career, but Milwaukee really benefited. You wind up with three very different pieces of land, often with different uses, often with different attributes. And what's wonderful, of course, with all of his park systems, whether they're in Milwaukee, Buffalo, Boston, or any of the others, Rochester, New York, any of the other cities he did them in, is what you in effect have is these were done in the 19th century. By now, the 21st century, you have several pieces of park, several parklands in the middle of a city abutting on all different kinds of neighborhoods. So really, Olmsted's original vision as a social reformer, it could not be borne out better than it is in Milwaukee and other places by having a variety of different neighborhoods surrounding these parks and all kinds of different people meeting and mixing and mingling in the parks.
He said about Central Park, for instance, it should be a place of tranquility for all the residents of the crowded metropolis,
mm-hmm.
for the poor and rich, young and old, the vicious and the virtuous.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that is so interesting is that because Olmsted appreciated the beauty of empty spaces, I mean, that his parks, by and large, tend not to be crowded with a lot of artifice, but that there is this simplicity about them and openness, that because of that, it's easy to take it for granted. Somebody might drive through a park and not even think that anyone ever designed this, that there's no design involved here at all.
It's so fascinating. One thing with Olmsted, and this is something that people are often, I was certainly shocked by it when I learned it, is he, in his park making, he was immensely, you might call it interventionist. He used, you know, gunpowder, and he used more gunpowder in the design of Central Park than was used at the Battle of Gettysburg. He would blow things up and cover things in. He would create man-made lakes that he would feed with pipes, and it would be like filling a bathtub. And in fact, in Milwaukee, if you go to Lake Park looks like it's just like it was always there. But Olmsted actually covered in one of the ravines. He filled it in because he didn't like the way it worked as a natural landscape. Other ravines he accentuated in various ways. He did his signature tree plantings all over Lake Park, where what he did was he loved to plant clumps of trees together to block what he thought was a less attractive view or to create suspense. So you're thinking, oh, there's a big clump of trees that's blocking my view right now. It makes you naturally kind of suspenseful. You think, what's in the distance? Then he would have these open vistas that suddenly open up, and of course in Lake Park they're stunning. Your view is blocked, you're in a ravine, all of a sudden a vista opens up and you have this stunning view of Lake Michigan in the distance. So Lake Park, Central Park, any of the other parks he did, it's remarkable how much intervention was required in the service of how much of a man-made park was necessary to create something that was very natural-looking. And one of the highest compliments, I should mention, Olmsted ever received was Horace Greeley, the newspaper, the journalist I mentioned earlier. When Central Park was complete, he walked up to Central Park, and he looked around, and he goes, well, they left it alone a whole lot more than I thought they would. And Olmsted took that as a high compliment because he knew full well that Central Park had not been left alone. It had required a lot of work to make it look natural.
Absolutely. And, of course, you tell us, too, that completion of Central Park was reviewed like one might review the premiere of a new symphony, and indeed it was a work of art. In addition to being a masterpiece of engineering, and that scenario plays out, of course, again and again throughout this long, remarkable career. The book again is called "Genius of Place: The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted." This is a Doc Koppel publication. The author, Justin Martin. Justin Martin, I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show, and I certainly thank you for writing such a fascinating and important book.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure to talk with you.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming award-winning author Peter Annan Wednesday evening, April 24th. He'll present the inaugural lecture in the Gunderson Lecture Series titled Great Lakes Water Tension in the 21st Century. Annan will discuss the challenges we face regarding sustainable water practices. A reception and book signing to follow. This event is free and open to the public. Details.